All right. So last but not least, modified assets, our favourite. End of debt.
Yeah. Okay, so agenda paper 8 addresses a question raised regarding the measurement of expected credit losses in respect of a modified financial asset which has not been derecognised. So IFRS 9 contains requirements pertaining to the treatment of modified financial assets where the modification does not result in derecognition, and it also contains guidance as to how such modified financial assets are treated for the purposes of the impairment requirements. So these requirements are further illustrated in one of the illustrative examples in IFRS 9, example 11. So the submitter notes, the submitter questions the application of these requirements, where the modification serves to renegotiate the terms of the loan in order to take into account the amounts that they expect the borrower can repay. And the submitter asks whether in such situations the expected credit loss allowance could be reduced to nil, because now the modified contractual cash flows are representative of the amounts that they expect the borrower can now repay. And the submitter also queries the appropriate presentation and disclosure requirements which would apply in that case. So before I open this one up to you for discussion, we would just refer back to some of the areas of guidance in IFRS 9 which we think would help with this question. So in the first instance, IFRS 9 has these requirements around modified financial assets. And in such cases, an entity has to do two things. Where there has not been a derecognition of the financial asset, you have to recalculate the new gross carrying amount, which would exclude any expectation of credit losses, and take a modification gain or loss to profit or loss. And then you also have to continue applying the impairment requirements to the modified financial asset in the same way as you would have done for an unmodified financial instrument. And therefore, this means that there is still a requirement to measure expected credit losses on that modified financial asset in accordance with IFRS 9. And even though the example that's provided by the submitter it presents a situation where the entity has renegotiated the contractual cash flows in a way that now reflects expectations of how much the borrower will be able to repay, and that may well result in the entity now considering that there is a far lower probability of a credit loss or a credit event occurring, IFRS 9 still does require that when you measure expected credit losses, you have to consider the possibility that a credit loss will occur, even if that possibility is considered quite low. So therefore, the expectation cannot be assumed that it will be nil, and the process will have to be gone through. And in terms of the appropriate presentation and disclosure requirements, we would just highlight the requirements of IS1 in terms of requiring the separate line item presentation of impairment losses and reversals in P&L, and also the fact that other items may be presented separately where that is important to the understanding of the entity's performance. And then in terms of disclosure requirements, IFRS 7 contains disclosure requirements pertaining to modified financial assets. And the discussion in the basis of conclusions does clarify that there is no distinction drawn between modifications which were undertaken for credit reasons or for other commercial reasons. And therefore, insofar as the modification in question is considered relevant to achieving that overall objective of credit risk disclosures, then they would be in scope of that disclosure requirement. And so I would now just hand over to you to get your views on the analysis that we've set out of the requirements and see if we have any different points of view.
Okay.
So this time I have the pleasure to give my views on paper number 8. I think before we go into the details and into the questions, I think modification is one of very complex situations we can have in the bank. We can have very simple situations for retail client where we do simple extension of 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, but we can also have very, very complex restructurings combined with derecognitions, new instruments coming. And I think when you look into the newspapers, they're full of these types of restructurings, which can last partially over years. Yeah. The question then is, when do we have to record what? Because very often certain modification, restructuring is signed at a certain point in time, and then until everything gets done and dusted, recorded and resolved, this can also again take long time. So you can have several situations, and I think each situation needs to be carefully analyzed what this means in this particular situation. So I think even if we have now a concrete example here, I just want to make you aware of that there are various cases, and each case might require a specific judgment how things need to be done. So in this case we have here in question number one, how should bank calculate the modification gain or loss? So the example provided here says we incurred a significant deterioration in credit risk. The client is still performing. The client is not credit impaired, so we still expect to get the cash flows. We then enter into a modification which does not result into a derecognition, and the client has no observable reduction in credit risk. So my assumption is that the net present value of after restructuring is still the same as before, despite the payments might come in differently. So the question is, do I have a modification gain or loss at this point in time at all? So if I, for example, grant concessions, so for example, have debt forgiveness, or I forgive certain interest payments, this, from my perspective, would trigger the impairment. So it's a question of how severe the modification in this point is. So I think when we enter into a modification, first it's important to identify what impact or write-down or whatever we face is driven by the modification, or which element or which driver was before we enter the into the modification. So those elements, from my perspective, which happened before the modification, should be recorded as items in as credit risk related items, and the additional concessions we then grant, which then require certain write downs or whatever, should then be recorded as modification losses in our roll forward. So that will be my view on question number one. I don't know whether John, I think. Shall we first start, do the question by question, or shall we first
Whatever you prefer.
I'm easy. So on question two, my view would be, the question is about how should Bank A measure a new lifetime expected loss at the reporting date after the modification? I think the standard only allows for a different concept when we purchase impaired loans, but there we have reflect the delta, have some kind of delta accounting in terms of this increase in credit risk. But in this case, I haven't found any rule which says I'm allowed to not calculate lifetime expected loss. So this means that after the restructuring, depending on in which stage I am, I will have to calculate either 1 year or lifetime expected losses for this particular asset after the restructuring. How should the modification gain or loss and movement should be presented in the disclosure? That's question three. Maybe looping back to my statements on question one, it depends on whether this is credit risk related and prior the modification, or whether we really have movements which incurred or happened because of the modification. So here I would, if possible, try to segregate what the effects are and then do the appropriate disclosure.
Can I just ask a clarification, if that's all right?
Sure.
On question one in particular. So in IFRS 9, we've actually got a definition of what a modification gain or loss is, and we say that a modification gain or loss shall be calculated by basically determining what your new contractual cash flows are, discounting them at the effective interest rate, and then you compare that amount with what your gross carrying amount was before, and I call that modification gain or loss. Now I've got a separate question about disclosure, but in terms of the actual calculation, is that the calculation you're doing? Because I'm not really, I don't think we make a distinction in terms of our definition of a modification gain or loss of why I modified the cash flows.
So I think this example, if we come to a different conclusion that the net present value based on my expected future cash flow is
contractual cash flows.
So
this is before losses.
So that's before the losses. So when I enter into a normal impairment situation or in a modification, what I'm doing, I calculate my expected future cash flows. And this is the same I do in the modification. So in the end, the result is a net present value, a new net present value. And if this is lower than my carrying amount, first of all, if I'm not in a modification, it would be an impairment loss, right?
Not if it's a contractual cash flows.
No, I mean, if I enter in a default situation, I do my expected, I discount my expected future cash flow, get my net present value, the delta to my carrying amount would be my loan loss allowance. So in a non-modification situation. The
so
reason why
change in what you expect to collect, but that's
right.
The same contractual amounts.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then,
so
yes.
The reason why I'm coming up with this example is the question is coming back to the example here. If I have to come up with a new net present value which is lower than my carrying amount, then I'm in a default or impairment situation. So the question is how significant is my restructuring? So if I really notice that my new book value based on the new expected future cash flows is lower than my original carrying amount, then I enter in an impairment situation. So the question then is, if I do this in the context of a modification, rather than the full amount, is a modification loss or gain, modification loss, or whether there was an impairment loss before. And I think this needs to be evaluated in the respective situation. But the example provided here is, from my perspective, either not complete or a little bit misleading, because I, in this situation described here, I won't have a modification loss because my net present value in the modification is the same as the one I had before based on my gross carrying amount.
I'm not sure that I agree, but let me set out my logic and see. I'll please others chip in, because this shouldn't just be what Sue Lloyd thinks. But because even if you expect, even if your net present value taking into account impairment was a particular number before.
Yeah.
So I looked at my contractual cash flows, I had my gross carrying amount, I looked at my expected losses, and I had an allowance, and I had a net carrying amount.
Okay.
To calculate the modification gain or loss, I sort of ignore what I've done about expected losses before, and I just say, okay, what are my new contractual cash flows, discount them at my old EIR, is that bigger or smaller than my old gross carrying amount, and that's what determines whether I've got a modification gain or loss.
Okay. So this would be then basically a delta. So I would have a new carrying amount. I have a delta. So I would then have to basically reduce my carrying amount, and I would then record this as a modification loss.
Yep.
Yeah? So I fully agree to this.
Yep.
The only question is, if I do this in this situation, my understanding was based on this example that I model my new contractual cash flows based on what the client is in the position to pay. So if I would not be in a modification situation, I would end up in an impairment situation, right?
Yes. but I don't think that changes the fact it's labelled modification, gain or loss.
Right, so if I would not be in a modification situation, I would have an impairment loss of this amount.
Yep.
Because I'm in a modification situation, a restructuring, I would call this as a modification loss.
And then as a second step, you'd calculate a new impairment allowance for that modified asset.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then on the next day after the restructuring, I would then again calculate lifetime expected losses because I would assume the client is still in stage two. Yeah. The only point here in this situation would be, would I immediately go from book value 100 to, let's say, 60 modified level, or would I have steps in between? I would not expect that clients who are in stage one immediately come to us and say, I need a modification, I can only pay you 60% of what I've paid before, without that this client enters stage three and we would record an impairment loss. Yeah. So I think we need to really carefully analyze what was there before. Was there significant deterioration and maybe default before we entered into the modification? And then segregate what was really the impairment loss and what was the modification loss. I would doubt that in this situation described here, the full amount would be modification loss. I would expect that there is an impairment loss before we enter into the modification.
But I think where maybe I have a disconnect and worries me nobody else is talking, but that is because even if I immediately before I assume I do the modification because things are dire and I'm trying to restructure so that they can pay, right? So you're right, in that situation one would hope there'd be quite a big allowance balance in place because of the credit risk of that obligor. So we had this allowance balance and we'd booked impairment. I still think that IFRS 9 requires that when you actually make the decision to change the contractual cash flows, change the contractual terms, you need to book a change in the carrying amount, label that modification gain or loss, and then as a second step measure an impairment allowance.
I agree with that. Also have some sympathy, so with maybe what perhaps you'll be trying to say, that's not necessary to go from, if we started with 100 was the original gross carrying amount and the recoverable amount, let's call it the NPV, is 60. It doesn't necessarily mean it's all go from 100 to 60, because it's one of the things that's not quite clear about this situation is you obviously have these rules on write-offs, and IFRS 9 says, you know, you write off amounts if there's no realistic prospect of recovery, and you apply that to a whole asset and you apply that to a part of an asset. So if you had this situation, contractual cash flow is 100, what you think is recoverable is 60, you've got no chance of getting back the extra 40, so say, well, let's restructure the loan.
If you had a write-off,
would you not write off the 40 first?
Yeah, you may. That's fair. You may have written down a portion of the loan first.
But can I ask that if to do the write-off that Chris suggests, do you have to stop pursuing collections? So if you're still with collection agencies, you're still chasing them, should you be doing that grossing down of the balance sheet if you're still chasing them?
I don't believe so. I think you need to have no realistic prospect of collecting. That doesn't mean you've stopped. You may want to continue for legal reasons. You may want to continue to make a marker in the marketplace for other clients. There may be other reasons you're continuing to collect, but it's when you get to a point where you've no realistic prospect of recovery, then you stop.
So it's not about the activity, it's about whether you think you're going to get the cash.
Exactly, because I think at some point we had discussions about the potential for recovery of something you had written off, which would be consistent with that. So I don't think we're disagreeing. I just wanted to make sure we were being clear for people listening.
Just to summarize on that one, I think what the staff prepared here, I support this. I just want to say the situation very often is more complex and not that plain vanilla as stated here. And we might have certain write-downs before we enter a modification, and then we need to segregate the effects.
So if I have an extra dollar of impairment loss before the modification, does that extra dollar of impairment loss change the modification gain or loss?
I think I have my certain expectation on what I can recover or what I expect going forward, based on that, I do my impairment assessment. If I then enter an application and I have to do even more, so add additional debt forgiveness or whatever, so in the context of the modification, then I would call this loss of modification, loss of modification loss.
Because I don't think it should. I think the way we've done the calculation is that
cash flows.
That modification gain loss is change in the contractual cash flows, EIR.
Mm-hmm.
What you did on impairment before shouldn't change that answer.
Exactly.
It may well change the credit gain or loss in the period, because you will then have another allowance after.
Yeah.
And that's the way it works.
I think the definition of a modification gain and loss is important. I think we're the only situation where you might get a difference is the example Chris has pointed out, which would be that if you actually had such a severe situation, you'd actually had a write-off, you would have reduced the gross carrying amount. That would then feed into the modification gain or loss. But if you were just talking about allowance levels, I don't think it can affect the modification gain or loss by definition, because it's pre the allowance measurements.
No, I think I agree.
Okay. John?
Yeah, I mean, I think the paper is very clear around the calculation, the modification gain or loss, and about the calculation of the ECL allowance, and I think I would agree that's where IFRS 9 gets you. But I think to your example, where you have a loan which is not modified, and you, let's say it's 100, and you've booked an impairment charge of 10, and then you modify it based on your expected cash flows, and therefore you modify it down to 90, because that's what you expect to get back, and the NPVs remain the same. That might be slightly unrealistic, but you would get to a different P&L answer as a result of the two-step approach, which I agree is what's in the standard, than you would have if you hadn't modified. Because if you hadn't modified, you'd be at 90, and you would have had an impairment loss of 10. Because you've modified, now you have a modified loss of 10, you have an impairment release of 10, but then you do another lifetime or 12 months, and let's say that's 1 or 50 or half, you'll book that. So economically, people might argue you're in the exact same situation. Well, you may not, because you've changed the cash flows, but a lot of people say to me, well, we're in the same situation, but I have a bigger P&L hit, why would I bother modify? And I think where the paper lands is what IFRS 9 requires, but it's an interesting observation.
Yep. And I think it's a useful paper for that reason, because it might be not what people expect the outcome to be, but I think it is.
I think so.
What people are confirming that would say.
In terms of disclosure, I agree with you. You need to consider whether you separate the modification gain if it's relevant. I would question how relevant it is if you do a modification and the modification is driven off credit. I would question, in my example, if you have a modification loss of 100 of 10 and a provision release of 10, and they are inextricably linked, I would think maybe the better presentation, I personally believe, on a credit-related modification is to net the two in the income statement and disclose in the balance and disclose in the notes as to the makeup of it. I'm not sure that it would make sense to have, particularly if you did a huge amount of restructuring, to have massive provision releases and then to have a massive modification loss, when economically what you're doing with the modification is in effect monetizing your loss, if you like. That would be one way I'd look at it. And then lastly, in terms of the IFRS 7 disclosure, I think, again, the paper's landed in the right place. I do think you have to disclose credit-related modifications and non-credit-related modifications under IFRS 7. I just question the relevance of mixing the two up. I think the reader is probably much more interested in modifications which arise on foot of credit than maybe, you know, normal day-to-day retail modifications, which are maybe more business-related. And while I accept they will have some impact on credit, they probably have a very minor impact on credit risk.
Yeah. I'd agree with your observations. I guess in terms of the, just personal views, obviously, in terms of the, you know, I had an allowance and now I've crystallised it by modifying, is there really information content and having those two flows? I think that there potentially is information content, because I think there's a difference between thinking there's a low likelihood of collecting and having an allowance and actually saying, okay, I'm not going to ask you for those cash flows anymore, so you've actually said, you know, I've got no right to them. So, but that could be addressed through disclosure, but I just think that it's slightly different.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid point. So my concern is having a big release going through my impairment line, and when one looks at the income statement, that reduces my overall impairment, and it may be better, I think it would be better done in note disclosure and to have the clean impairment line.
And I don't disagree with that. It's just rather, I think that we need, I would hope people would be thinking about the fact that there would be some information content, so somewhere it would probably be good to know.
But we think you'd need to grow some somewhere in the notes.
And on your other point, which was on, I forgot what I was going to say.
5%.
On the disclosures, yes. Sorry, the board, I think, did think about this, or at least the staff did, when the papers were written from memory, because we did realise that there might be a difference in terms of the information content of modifications for credit reasons versus other reasons. But my recollection is that the distinction wasn't made in the requirements, because we previously had such a distinction in IFRS 7 that we were asked to take out because people said that it wasn't operational to identify the cause. So we were trying to balance the information need, which I think the paper does quite a good job of bringing out. The sort of overall disclosure objective helps you work out what's useful disclosure without reinserting a line that we've been told before wasn't operational. So that's my defence. Did anybody have observations to add in addition to those comments on modifications? Tom?
We have a comment on the example number L11, which was mentioned in the papers. It is a clear example. However, we were wondering why the credit loss provision is increased by 70 after the modification, and we thought it would have been better when it would have been clarified that the reason for doing that was this might create questions.
Any other observations? Or okay, then with that, we'll confirm those observations in the paper, and we'll. And the disclosure points, I think it's helpful for people if we bring out the objective of the credit risk disclosure in conjunction with the modification scope and the way that it was in the paper, so we'll highlight that. In terms of next steps, I'll let Kuma add anything if I miss anything. But firstly, I'd like to say thank you very much. I think it's been a very constructive meeting, from my perspective at least. I hope you found it interesting and helpful, and I haven't cut you off inappropriately, and I apologise if I have. I think it's been an interesting debate for me, and I hope for people listening to us. And so our next scheduled meeting is in September, but I'm sure we'll be in touch before then, definitely with papers before then. But thank you very much for today. Very much appreciate it. Kuma, did we have anything to follow up? So with that, we can call the meeting to a close. Thank you.
Thank you.